republic or democracy? That's a question we'll look at next on Principles and Policies. Hello, this is Chuck Michaelis. I'm your host here on Principles and Policies. And it's an important question I asked at the front, republic or democracy. We've heard a lot, you know, after the events of July 13th, we've heard an awful lot of talk about existential threats to democracy. If you'll recall, after someone attempted to assassinate Donald Trump and managed to kill someone in the crowd, we've had a number of things go on. And we're going to talk a little bit more about some shows I put out earlier. We've heard a lot of talk about how our democracy is under attack and that kind of thing. Well, do we actually live in a democracy? That's the real question. I would say that the answer is no, but however, we are becoming one very rapidly. And this is not a new topic for this show. We've kind of talked about the difference between a republic and democracy in the past. But we're going to go more into it today. Okay, today's show is being recorded on July 26, 2024 for the July 27th, 2024 show. I want to start out with talking about after the event of, you know, the attempted assassination. What's the first thing that the President of the United States came out and said? We need to tone down the rhetoric. We need to tone down this rhetoric. What did he mean by that? Well, that's a good question, because the finger he was pointing seemed to be pointing at the conservative side. And there's an old saying, and we kind of laugh about it. It's a little too simplistic, but when you point your fingers, you point a finger at someone, remember that you have three pointing back at you. And that's exactly the case, because really there's heated rhetoric on both sides. Let's not kid ourselves. But when one side is saying to itself, is saying out loud, we need to tone down the rhetoric, what do they mean? Do they mean saying things like comparing Donald Trump to a Nazi, comparing Donald Trump to a fascist, claiming he's a fascist, saying he will openly, that he will declare himself dictator on his first day? By the way, that's taken from a joke that he made at some place. Somebody asked him a question, and he'd made some flip comment about dictator on the first day. Let's not kid ourselves, folks. Presidents very often come in and upend policy that has been made by his predecessor in areas where he can do that. Now, what's within the first week of Donald Trump leaving office and Joe Biden taking over, he killed pipelines. He stopped drilling, oil drilling permits. He did all kinds of things to completely counter all the progress. And I'll be quite honest, when gasoline is under $2 a gallon when a president leaves office, and within a week it's over $2.50. Something has gone on. Something fundamental has gone on. The left does not like the fact that Donald Trump was willing to make us oil independent, because by the time Donald Trump had left office, we were not only oil independent, we were exporting crude oil. But it's not just about that. What does that have an effect on? Those kinds of things have an effect on the cost of doing business. the cost of generating electricity. Those of you who are out there paying attention to your electric bill, what has happened to it in the last 4 years? Those of you who are paying attention to your grocery bill, what has happened to it in the last 4 years? Now, were those completely dependent upon energy prices? No, but was it a big, large part of it? You bet it was. During the pandemic, which, by the way, is another point of contention, President Biden wants to point back at Donald Trump for all these bad things that happened under his watch with the pandemic. The stuff that really happened that was really, really, really bad did not come into effect until Joe Biden took office. And I'm talking about masking mandates, businesses required to close down. And I'll be quite right up front with you. We had a Republican here, our current governor, who soon will be out, and I'll be very happy with that, Mike DeWine, was a big player in that. He brought in a really bad player to be his health director. She's Mike DeWine, supposedly pro-life, and this is a woman who is very blatantly pro-murder, pro-infant murder. In fact, she opened there were some abortion clinics that were closed, and she got them back open. Amy Acton, Dr. Amy Acton, who we refer to here as Dr. Amy Quackton. That kind of thing went on during the pandemic. There were gross overreaches of government authority, segueing into another thing. It made terrible assaults on quote-unquote democracy. Now, people often equate democracy with freedom. Freedom and democracy and blah, blah, blah. You know, World War One, President Wilson talked about how we were going to make the world safe for democracy. Well, A, that didn't work, because what happened during the war, whole swaths of, and actually at World War II, which was the continuation of World War One, what happened? Well, the Soviet Union took over from what used to be called Russia. And by the way, Russia's back. If you're paying attention, the Soviet Union is no more. I have caught myself referring to the Soviet Union. And gosh, there hasn't been a Soviet Union now for 32 years. Now, it didn't break up right away, but 1992 was when the the Russian state really started, the old Soviet Union fell apart, and if you recall, Russia formed a new thing called the Commonwealth of Independent States, and some of the old Russian republics pulled out. Take note that Ukraine pulled out, and actually, one of the conflicts that's going on now was when Ukraine pulled out, it took some territory that didn't belong to it, was sort of put into its safekeeping in 1954. The Crimea and some of those far eastern provinces of Ukraine used to be part of far western provinces of Russia. And Russia wants it back. They did take the Ukraine back, and then there was a big deal. We talked about going to war over that and that kind of thing. Okay, we're off the topic. These are historical events that come out of this, the sort of the mystic draw of democracy. And I'm going to play some audios in a little bit here that are going to talk about some of this, and we're going to interact with it. But since that July 13th event, and that we need to tone down the rhetoric, has the rhetoric toned down? Well, of course it hasn't. And we've gone through another crisis here in our country having to do with the sitting president of the United States, as you're all well aware. If you're not aware what's going on, I want to know what cave you're living in. And if you're listening to this show, how did you suddenly discover this program? How did you suddenly discover that there was radio, let alone television and the internet? Because the president of the United States has been forced through, I'll be quite honest, through a coup. There has nothing else that can be said, because he did not want to go. He has pulled out of the presidential race. He did not want to go. Basically, Democratic leaders went to him and said, either you pull out. Now, I don't know this for a fact. But remember, this is things I talked about on my radio show for the last couple of weeks, two, 3 weeks. I predicted these things were going to happen. I said, Joe has to go. And I said, it's going to happen very quickly. Well, it happened within a week of the last time I said it had to happen. And what did I say had to happen? He has to withdraw from the presidential race. And I said, if he doesn't, they will use the 25th Amendment and remove him from office. Now, that could still happen. I don't see that happening at this point. And I also made a prediction that has not come true. I didn't think the anointed candidate would be Kamala Harris, and I am still not 100% convinced that it couldn't happen this way, but it looks like Kamala Harris is going to be the anointed Democratic candidate for President of the United States on the Democratic side. Now, it's interesting that one of the big power brokers did not endorse her immediately. In fact, it took days and days and days, but it happened this morning, and that is that the Obamas have come out and endorsed Kamala Harris for the job. That's probably the death knell for my prediction that it was going to be Michelle Obama. So you heard it here first, folks. I'm admitting that my crystal ball had a glitch. It does look like the candidate's going to be Kamala Harris. The reasons for that are becoming obvious. I think the Obamas and the Democratic machine figured out they could not broom Kamala Harris out. And by the way, they don't like her. No one likes Kamala Harris. And yet, all you had to do was watch what the news media did to her before the announcement that Joe Biden was pulling out of the race, which was done, interestingly enough, on a Sunday. Kamala was not treated with kid gloves by any stretch of the imagination. She was manhandled a little bit by the press, not at the same level that the press loves to manhandle conservative Republicans. Let's not kid ourselves. But she is not well-liked. She was not really well-liked in California, although they elected her senator. But you basically have to be, if you get the party nod in California as a Democrat, it's essentially a automatic, the Republican is not going to get elected. The last time a Republican got elected to major state office was Arnold Schwarzenegger, who really wasn't much of a Republican. He was essentially a Kennedy clanner, and he followed up in a large field, by the way, on a recall election from a guy, Gray Davis, who was so egregiously bad as the governor that he was recalled and replaced with Arnold Schwarzenegger. And that's been, 2003. Arnold Schwarzenegger was elected in a recall in 2003. Well, that's 21 years ago. So California has done nothing but drift further left, further to the socialist far left ideologue side. So no one should be surprised about seeing someone like Kamala Harris be elected senator, and now as she was picked as a first-term senator to be the vice presidential candidate in 2020. Despite the fact, now it's interesting, Joe Biden said flat out, he said he wanted a black woman to be his vice presidential candidate. That's fine. He wanted a woman for sure. I think he wanted a black woman. Now here's the problem. Kamala Harris is not African black. She's not black per se. She's Indian. Her ancestry is from the Asian subcontinent. So when you hear it, get confusing information about her racial makeup. She is Indian, as was Nikki Haley on the Republican side. And Nikki Haley was very open about hers. Kamala Harris has been a little bit nebulous about her makeup, but nonetheless, that's the case. Now, what's interesting is that Kamala Harris did so badly when she ran for president in 2020 that she actually got forced out before the first primary. She got forced out after the caucuses. She got forced out of the race. And one of the reasons is because Tulsi Gabbard, who was a congresswoman from Hawaii, took her to the cleaners. Now, I've always been kind of a fan of Tulsi Gabbard. And Tulsi Gabbard is a liberal Democrat, but she's not an ideologue. She is a reasonable, I would call, we used to call these moderate Democrats. Her ideas are not hyper-radical. And she's very smart, and she is a veteran. And I think she continues to serve in the reserves. And I for a long time, I've been a fan of Tulsi Gabbard. Tulsi Gabbard took Kamala Harris apart in 2020 at the debates. And who was it that was basically told that she had 0% chance? Tulsi. Tulsi was essentially forced out of the Democratic Party. Tulsi Gabbard right now is an independent. She's not in Congress anymore. She is kind of making commentary and that kind of thing. She is very intelligent and makes... And again, liberal. But it's interesting to find out that Tulsi Gabbard's parents were Republicans. And Tulsi is, racially, is a Pacific Islander. Asia Pacific Islander is the group. In some ways, those fit together. In some ways, they don't. So, you know, Joe Biden had a choice. He could have moderated made himself appear more moderate by appointing the likes of Tulsi Gabbard, by bringing her in. The problem is that she, again, the Democratic Party is very, very radicalized, as we've seen with some of the actions of the things we've seen come out of the Democratic Party. I mean, when Chuck Schumer is the head of the Senate, the majority party, and Chuck Schumer is your head, that's pretty radical, folks. Chuck Schumer is ultra radical, and all you have to do is look at what's coming out of the Biden administration. The stuff is radical. Well, in any case, Kamala Harris, Tulsi Gabbard was ignored. Kamala Harris was made the candidate to appease the radical. Radicals in the party. Okay, well, is that democratic? Well, okay, this brings us to our discussion. This brings us to the important point of the discussion. I'm going to bring in Gary DeMar, and I've done some things with Gary DeMar's material. In fact, a lot of my stuff that I've done on God and government, if you recall, God, government, and governance, I did. A lot of it is derived from a class that I've taught many, many, many times called God and Government, written by Gary DeMar. And Gary DeMar is with American Vision. And I'll tell you right up front, AmericanVision.org. And they put out a lot of books. It's heavy on eschatology. A lot of you I know out there do not agree with my eschatology, and that's fine. You don't have to. to understand Gary DeMar's books, because Gary DeMar does a lot of other things besides eschatology. He does a lot of government and governance and that kind of thing. And it's all very good. Well, it's not just him. There are a number of authors thinkers and philosophers from the Christian perspective, and they republish books from the past. They do all kinds of things. It's AmericanVision.org. AmericanVision.org. I think you can get there AmericanVision.com too. .com may be the bookstore. But AmericanVision.org, you can find these things. I'm going to see if I can post a link when I post this up to the podcasts I'm going to use. But I'm going to play a clip from Kamala Harris first, from an advertising, and it's got a lot of noise in it, so you'll have to listen carefully. A lot of music, unfortunately loud music and a lot of noise, but she's going to ask a question. So let's go to that.
In this election, we each face a question. What kind of country do we want to live in?
That's an important question. What kind of country do we want to live in? And this is part of this question about republic versus democracy. Okay, let's go and listen to what Gary DeMar says about this. DeMar's going to talk about democracy versus republic here.
So democracy in and of itself has to be explained and defined before you can just say the subversion of to subvert democracy, because those on the left, if they don't get their way and they don't have enough people in order to get their way, and people vote to throw them out or put into, you know, to elect a president who then puts people on the Supreme Court, then ends up changing the law, all of a sudden democracy doesn't look like a good thing.
Right. And it gets thrown around all the time. But as we pointed out in the previous podcast, we are not a democracy. We were not set up as a democracy. The founding fathers knew what a democracy was, and that's one of the things that they were coming away from and out of and purposefully set us up as something else. But when we hear over and over again that we are a democracy, think in your mind, no, we're not.
Yeah, let me go through some of this. Democracy has become essentially the new political god, and the democracy. Really, the power is not in the people. The power is in the people. The people themselves put into power,
right?
And those votes are typically bought in order to put them into power. So it's a false democracy when you got to pay people to vote for you and do things for them, and we take money away from these people and give it to other people, and then calling that democracy. That is not democracy.
Okay, that's an important consideration. Think about this. What did he mean by that? He shorthanded things there a little bit. What has the Democratic Party, and to some extent the Republican Party, let's not kid ourselves, but what are some of the major things that the Democratic Party has done to try to, quote-unquote, buy votes? Well, this is what always happens in a democracy. When you expand the vote, originally in this country, and a big deal is made about this and said it was an elitist, kind of an elitist thing, which it really isn't, okay? When you expand the vote to allow people who have no vested interest in a situation, especially having to do with the public funds, you can get people to do things like vote themselves a raise in welfare benefits, or in to tax others to fill your own pocket. The famous quote by Maggie Thatcher, socialism works until you run out of other people's money. And that is exactly what happens. Eventually, you tax the taxpaying public, the productive people in a society, you tax them to the point where they are no longer can simply say, okay, it's no longer worth it for me to continue to contribute to society in the way that I have in the past. Therefore, I'm going to drop out. There is an entire book put out by Ayn Rand, and I'm not endorsing her, the totality of her philosophy, by any stretch of the imagination. But she put out a book called The Atlas Shrugged. And that, the whole premise behind Atlas Shrugged is that basically those who are productive and are sick and tired of having being taken advantage of by politicians and by people who are picking their pockets for their own welfare just suddenly get together and sort of all the productive people in the country get together and go on strike and say, okay, we're not going to make the railroads run. We're not going to, our factories are going to shut down. All these things happen. And what happens? Well, society collapses, of course, because you cannot continue to steal from those who are productive members of society to support those who are not productive members of society. I'm not talking about people who are ill or that kind of thing. That's a different discussion. People who are incapable of doing things, the mentally incompetent, and people who are physically incapable of doing certain things. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about people who are perfectly healthy and who are living on the dole, people who are professional students, for instance. Okay, what did Joe Biden, what one of the first things he tried to do and has not gotten away with it so much, he wanted to do a complete forgiveness of student debt. Well, since student debt, student loans are essentially made by banks and financial institutions, and guaranteed by the federal government. In other words, the federal government does not supply the money for the loans. The banks do, in anticipation of being paid back for them. So what happens when people stop paying their student loans? The banks get stuck. Well, are the banks actually stuck? No, because the federal government guarantees those loans. Therefore, the bank gets a lot less money back. By the way, the guarantees are a laugh. Nonetheless, there is a guarantee made, and the federal government would then become responsible for those loans. Now, you can get a reason. You can listen to the rhetoric coming out of the left, who've said this for years. Why doesn't the federal government just make more money to make up for, you know, to make sure these payments can get made and that kind of thing, so we can take over this debt? Why don't we, you know, why doesn't the federal government assume credit card debt? Why doesn't the federal government assume this and that and another debt? Just print more money to, hey, we've been printing money to do that. And I'll be the first to tell you that Donald Trump was not good on this point during his presidency, because we spent way too much money. But so much money got spent on the stimulus during the pandemic. Now, remember, that's under Joe Biden. So much money got sent on, you know, we all got checks. We all got supposed reimbursement. What was the purpose of that? Well, it's the idea that the economy runs on the spending of consumers. And consumers weren't spending. Why? Half of them weren't working. They were told not to come to work. Their businesses were closed down. Some people were able to go back to work working from home. And what it did was it's sort of like Prohibition. When Prohibition came in, did liquor stop? And the answer is no. What happened to it? It went to another source. Another source suddenly started producing liquor from the licensed, taxed, and revenue center of alcohol before the Prohibition. it went to another source. Now, the fact the source is who stepped in because it was illegal, who always steps in when there's a black market, it was organized crime. But that's not the point. The point is that somebody else picks up the slack. Who picked up the slack during the pandemic when you couldn't go down to here, there, or another place to pick something up because they were closed, or you had to mask up, or you had to you really weren't supposed to be out driving around? Mail order stuff. Okay, Amazon, eBay. A lot of companies went to ordering direct from them. And who benefited most from that was probably Amazon. It did manage to kill a number of brick and mortar stores. It really drove a stake through what was left of the whole mall culture. Mall culture is dead, in case you haven't gone to your local mall recently. What's in there? Well, you've got all kinds of weird stuff that, you know, that it didn't belong in a mall. You went down to the mall to get a suit or a pair of shoes or maybe some jewelry or some clothes, whatever. You don't do that anymore. Why? Because that particular part of the culture is dead. Businesses couldn't deal with the change in shopping. And, you know, I have never understood it until I thought about it. And I said, you know, you can save 40% by ordering it from Amazon over going down to the mall and buying it. Yeah, you can wait an extra day or two. What does that mean? Look at it. Government policy can drive business policy. And government policy can do things like attempt to buy votes by forgiving student loans. Now, what does that do to the thousands and thousands and thousands of millennials? Not just millennials. There are people from all walks of life and ages who took out student loans and are looking at it and are like, gosh, if I can get this forgiven, why wouldn't I support this effort to forgive my $80,000 in college loan debt? Well, you take that $25, $50, $80, $100,000 in student loan debt, and you say, we're going to forgive that. Why are you going to forgive it? There's the only reason to forgive it is to buy the vote. And that's what DeMar's talking about. I'm giving you a single issue, and that is student loans. But that's not the only, by far. We want to compensate you for this. We think you deserve compensation for this, for that, for another thing. That's what DeMar's talking about. Buying votes by forgiving debts, by subsidizing something else. We're in a housing crisis right now. What are some of the proposals that are out there being talked about? Some of the proposals that are out there being talked about are basically providing down payments. Now, my daughter and my son-in-law, I have two daughters, and they each have been able to buy a house. My daughter here lives in Columbus, Columbus right now is a tough real estate market. I looked at what houses cost over there. I know my wife and I sold a house 8 years ago in Westerville, suburban Columbus, and we had paid in 1996, we had paid $121,000 for this house. And I told my wife I wanted to move because the taxes were just getting outrageous in Westerville. And I just was tired of the traffic. I wanted to get out to the country. And I told my wife, I said, you know, we can get about $195,000 for this place. And she laughed at me. She goes, we'll never get that much out of this. We did a little bit of work. And, you know, we fixed the place up a little bit, stuff she wanted to have done anyway. You know how that is, folks. Your wife wants you to do stuff. And we fixed it up, and I think we got $191,000 or $192,000 out of it, which we then put in 100% into the property we live in now. It was just essentially a swap. We bought 6 acres, 6.5 acres, and a house a little slightly smaller, which is fine. Our kids were all moving out. That inflation had done that. Well, the last time we checked, our house has been sold twice since we, once more since we sold it. The people that bought it sold it for they bought it for $191,000. They sold it for $258,000, I think. And this is only 3 or 4 years after we had sold it. And the last time I checked the Zillow value on that house, and it all looks pretty much the same as it did when we left, was almost $300,000. The house I live in now is worth significantly more. The real estate market here is tough, tough, tough. And what does that mean for beginning house buyers? It means they don't have the money to get that done. So what's the federal government deciding to do? They're seriously looking at providing down payment money or putting a cap on what houses can be sold for. Consequences of trying to buy votes. This is that whole Democratic idea that socialism works, and yes, this is socialism. Socialism works until you run out of other people's money. Flat out. That's what's happening. Now, people will say, well, that's not really socialism. Of course it is. If the government is stepping in and taking money from one set of people and giving it to someone else, redistributing wealth, that's socialism. That is essentially Marxism, if you will, from each according to his means to each according to his needs. We've done this for decades with providing food stamps. We don't do food stamps anymore. It's EBT cards. But we have robbed Peter to pay Paul rather than making incentives for companies to come here and have jobs that pay well enough that people can buy rent or buy a home and buy their own groceries. Instead, we choose to tax, give the money to someone else, and then tout ourselves as a big hero of the people for having robbed the money barons, those horrible people who run the corporation. And I won't kid you that there aren't horrible people that do run corporations. I've worked for a couple of them. A couple of them were simply mismanaged beyond belief. Now, could I have done a better job at certain levels? Not at the corporate level. At the manager position level, could I have made things work more efficiently? Yeah. What would that have done? That would have made the company more profitable. And that would necessarily have meant lower prices to be competitive. That's the whole point. When you have government running and setting the parameters for how business works and how money is taxed and distributed, you have trouble on your hands. Why? Because all of a sudden you've got bureaucrats, and we've seen it in recent hearings in the House of Representatives and in the Senate. Bureaucrats who basically want to be appointed to jobs, have no clue, have never actually worked in industry, ever, 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 and yet are involved in regulating industry. Why do they do that? It's at the behest of special interest groups. What in Federalist Papers number 10 were called factions? These are special interest groups composed of either a minority or a majority. Okay, I want to go further on. Gary DeMar is going to give a little more on that particular subject.
There's the Latin phrase, vox populi, vox Dei, the voice of the people is the voice of God. And Francis Schaeffer described democracy as the dictatorship of the 51%, mm-hmm. with no controls and nothing with which to challenge the majority.
Yeah, and again, that's purely assuming that 100% of the people have a voice. Right. So if you have a population and everybody spoke and 51% of those people wanted this and 49 wanted this, well, democracy says we go with this. But we all know that 100% of the people don't speak. They don't have a voice.
Yeah. People say, well, that's their problem. And it's only the voters that count. OK, well, fine. So 51% of the people decided that Nazism, National Socialism was the way they wanted to go. And they wanted to get rid of the Jews. Who's to say otherwise?
Right.
And this was I mentioned this before, those at the Nuremberg trials, the judges there, the justices, had a problem determining what Germany did that was wrong.
Okay. That last point is a little outside the scope, but it goes to the point that democracy is the dictatorship of the 51%. In a republic, the needs of the voiceless, if you will, the co-host there kind of brought this up. The needs of the co-host are the needs of the co-host. The needs of the not necessarily voiced persons. And remember, we're controlled by the people who go out and vote. This is a point I tried to get done last year during the special election in August of 23 and then in November of 23 with amendment to the Ohio Constitution. One of the things we ran into was, A, you had a special election in August, which I hate, by the way. I hate special elections in August. But I understood the timing on this one. It had to be done. The special, what it basically attempted in August was to make it so it required a supermajority of voters to change the Ohio Constitution. As it currently stands, you can have a referendum and change the Ohio Constitution with 50% plus one of the vote. Okay? That is a democratic approach to the Constitution written large. Is that supposed to be what happens? Well, one of the reasons that Ohio's constitution is such a jumbled mess, first of all, when they made it up, the United States Constitution is easy to read, easy to understand. Yes, you have to get past the language barrier. We're not going to go there. You have to go online and look up Webster's 1828 dictionary and look up the words. It's really not that tough. Yeah, some of them have fallen out of common use, but that doesn't mean that they don't have meaning and they're not there to see. Okay, Ohio wrote a positive law document and the U.S. Constitution is a negative law document. What does that mean? What that means is the Constitution basically says, A, it outlines the powers of the government, not the rights of the people, per se, except in the Bill of Rights. All right. The powers of government. It lays it out and it says, you're not allowed to do anything. That's the negative part. You're not allowed to do anything except these things. And it specifically lays out what the powers and duties and authorities of the government, the federal government, are. And the Bill of Rights took a look at that layout, which is pretty specific in the main body of the Constitution, and the first 10 amendments took a look at it and says, okay, we're just in case there's a question, we're going to reiterate this and we're going to lay out specifically things that the federal government can't do. And if you read those amendments, you'll see that the way they're laid out is in such a way as to say, okay, And if we left anything out, especially like the Ninth and the Tenth Amendment, if we, you know, just because it that's not laid out specifically here doesn't mean the federal government has the power to do it. Okay, so we went from that negative document to a positive document. Well, here's what you can do. Here's what you can do. Here's what you could do this and this and this and this and this. And it starts like, and when documents become, when constitutions, for instance, become positive law documents, they get longer and longer and longer and longer and longer and longer. Why? Because you have to specifically say the things. You have to specifically lay them out rather than laying out a framework and saying, if it doesn't fit in this framework, it doesn't work. You suddenly have to lay out everything and do it iteratively and do it piece by piece by piece by piece. Well, why did I make this segue into positive versus negative law? The Ohio Constitution in November of 23 was amended in a very bad, bad way. And those of us who had read the thing knew this was going to be actually absolutely terrible. And we wanted to make it so that, and this is the way it should have been from the get-go, from the beginning, we wanted to make it require a supermajority. That is, enough people care to go out and vote yes or vote no about changing fundamental things in the Ohio Constitution. We wanted to make it harder and make it a requirement of a supermajority. Well, that failed. And it failed pretty substantially. And then when November came and this awful amendment, which basically said that you could murder a baby right up until just before birth. Not only that, but that you can, that children can be converted at their request without their parents' permission into, you know, to have themselves sexually mutilated and having their quote unquote their gender changed, which you can't do surgically. You can't do any way except by the art of creation, which you can't do. Only God can do that. Nonetheless, we tried to stop that from happening. And people, what was one of the arguments? Oh, no, this is an interference with democracy. If you pass this thing in August, you will... you know, you'll interfere with democracy. Well, what we've just heard from Gary DeMar is the fact that, and that final point that he made was part of the point. They couldn't figure out at the Nuremberg trials exactly what the Nazis had done wrong, because if you are thinking about democracy as a god and the majority in Germany wanted to take the minority in Germany and steal all their property and steal their labor and then work them to death or simply send them to a place where they, because they're old or too young or ill, because they're useless to the Reich, to simply dispose of them as surplus population. What made that wrong? Well, the answer to a Christian should be obvious. So the same question remains, who's looking to do that in this country? Well, nobody right now, except in terms of the abortion issue. And what is one of the Democratic Party's main arguments regarding why the Republican Party is a threat to democracy? It's a threat to democracy because, well, supposedly Republicans are pro-life. They want to stop women from being able to exercise their right, quote-unquote, to murder their infants. There is no such right. And that's the whole point. Government cannot hand out rights. Government can only guarantee rights. And that's, again, part of that difference between a negative document, negative constitutional document, and a positive constitutional document. You can create a right with a positive document. It's not really a right because rights only come from God. But the fact is that one of the things that the big worry is that the Republicans will supposedly wipe out the right to reproductive freedom. Well, let's be clear about this. One of the big arguments, one of the main problems I've had with the Republicans recently is they're walking away from those guarantees. They're walking away from the social parts of the platform. In fact, they took out sections in the Republican platform. You may not have heard about this, and you may have, and you, feel free to go do the research, because they took out the abortion planks, the elimination. Now that Roe v. Wade has passed, the excuse is it's gone back to the states. Well, it has gone back to the states, and what's gone on? Ohio, one of the a stalwart pro-life state, came out, and because not enough people came out and voted in that August election, and then again in the November election, we now have essentially no restrictions on abortions allowed in Ohio. It's not quite there yet. All the shouting is not done, but that's going to be the outcome. A judge is going to look at that amendment and say, I have no choice. I have to wipe out all abortion restrictions, period. Now, how soon will that be? It won't be too long. You watch. If the legislature tries to pass something, that then a lawsuit will be brought, and there's no option. If the legislature comes out and tries to pass a law saying that no, you cannot cut parents out of the loop on transgender, which is, people are out there advocating for that and working for that, they will say, no, you can't do that. This new amendment does not allow the state to restrict anyone from doing things, minor or not, to make themselves from into something they cannot be, despite the fact that it may be a temporary or a gender dysphoria is a big thing in adolescence sometimes. It's an issue, and people snap out of it. Well, if they don't snap out of it and they start giving puberty blockers and that kind of thing, we're not going to go into this argument, but it has major, profound effects on intellectual development and physical development, and people can end up sterilizing themselves. It's a self-sterilization process. Okay. How did that happen? Democracy. Because we had a thing that where we tried to restrict the flow of democracy for the right reasons, to keep things, changes from being made on the zeitgeist, the spirit of the age, because of what amounts to a form of hysteria where people get cranked up and want to do things that they look back on and say, wow, that was a mistake. That's why democracy is dangerous. Things get done rapidly. They get done because there's a hue and cry, and they get done because not all the arguments have been heard.
C. Greg Singer argued that, and I'm quoting, modern political theory has replaced the doctrine of the sovereignty of God with that of the sovereignty of man. Mm-hmm. And again, the people as in mass do not really control the country if that's going to be defined as democracy. What happens is the people in control use manipulation in order to get people to vote for them. It's like, what have you done for me lately? And so the people say, okay, we want this, we want this, we want free health care, we want you to eliminate the debts of our student loans. We want this. If you do those things, we'll vote for you.
Mm-hmm.
So the people in a democratic way are voting for essentially theft. So there's no intrinsic value in democracy, in the will of the people.
And once anybody gets involved in the system, they never come back. It's once you're in Washington, once you're in the halls of government, you stay there. You might move around to different offices, but I mean nobody ever goes serves out their term and comes back home and goes back to their farm like it was originally intended. You went and you served. Now you go and it's a lifetime appointment.
Oh yeah, I mean think of Joe Biden, who was in Congress for 40 years, yeah. Never really had a job,
yeah.
and then making laws for people who have jobs and who own businesses.
The point DeMar is making there is once you slide over into democracy thinking versus republic thinking, and republic thinking is involved. Now, I won't kid you that republics don't also have problems, but in our case, the reason we have a republic is to protect those who perhaps don't have a voice, to ensure that the rights apply to all. And rights do not include the right to kill babies, the right to steal money, to burn down cities, to steal the largesse of places, employers, and that kind of thing, to pick the pocket of employers. And again, I'm not saying to you that one side right, one side wrong. That's the whole point. If there are things that are going on that are bad, you can construct society so that there are ways to air grievances privately. Listen, if I took a job tomorrow and I didn't like the way, you know, I get in there, I get trained, and I figure out what's going on, and they're not running the business as efficiently as they probably should, the first thing I say to myself is, gosh, this would run more efficiently if we did this. And you make your suggestion to the boss, and he tells you to shut up and go out and shove boxes around in the warehouse. Fine, okay, I'll do that. And that is a Republican idea. If I get together and we decide to get a mob together and we're gonna, you know, toss this idiot who runs this department and you know, do it as a mob action, that's democracy. That's why now you have to understand that our government has elements of all that in there. Yes, are we a republic? But how do we get our leaders? We elect them democratically. For the most part. Now, the president is not elected democratically. You may think he is, but he's not. He or she, as the case may be. They're not elected democratically. They are elected through an electoral college, and it's done that way to avoid the exact issue. Now, that we're talking about, that the rights of the people who are rural get mown over by the people who are live in the cities. And that electoral college actually protects rural people from being run roughshod over by urban dwellers. Okay. Now, Senate appointments are done popular vote, but they didn't always used to be. Now, some states had popular vote, but it was determined by the state how to pick state senator, how to pick members of the Senate. Of course, members of the House of Representatives are chosen direct democratically. In your district, you go vote for, as it stands now, Republicans versus the Democrats. There are occasionally an independent or something gets elected. But that being said, our government, therefore, and the president is slightly monarchical. He's not really. He's more of a constitutional monarch. So we have elements of democracy. We have elements of aristocracy in the courts. And we have elements of monarchy in the presidency. Okay, you know.